Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 679, titled Free at Last, Analysis of the Khobar Towers Bombing, subtitled Love Means Never Having to Say You're Saudi, Part 2. This program is being recorded on July 12th of the year 2009. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, please use the website spitfirelist.com. I have a massive new website, much more user-friendly, tons of information, descriptions of various broadcasts, and at this point, use of that website is essential in order to complete an understanding of the broadcast. It is, quite frankly, the greatest source for anti-fascist information on earth, if I do say so myself. It's all there. It's all available for free. Please use it. And by the way, if you don't like what you're hearing, there's a page on which to click to support the work that I'm doing. No better way of fighting back. Now, to the subject material at hand, and again, I think using the website and the massive amount of information about not only the Saudi elite's complicity in events of September 11th, 2001, but beyond that, and perhaps even more importantly, the profound fifth column in this country, including elements associated with the Bush administrations, and as we're going to see, former FBI Director Louis Freeh, greatly aided in the September 11th attacks, in some cases simply by inertia, in some cases by active conspiracy. Louis Freeh's name, by the way, and there's the pun in the title, is F-R-E-E-H. So Free at Last is F-R-E-E-H at last. And we're going to talk about his complicity, his deep complicity in the Khobar Towers bombing. Now, there's a wonderful five-part series that has been made available by the Interpress Service News Agency, and a major tip of the hat for this heroic piece of investigative reporting goes to Garrett Porter. It's a five-part series. It is, again, about the Khobar Towers bombing. And what it talks about here is how Saudi influence, in particular Saudi capital, has basically bought immunity from powerful elements of the Saudi establishment that are not only complicit in attacks that took place in the 1990s, but beyond that, elements of the Saudi elite, in turn part of the petroleum industry milieu and the underground Reich milieu, that basically executed September 11th and have continued to perpetrate attacks around the world. We're going to close this broadcast with an infuriating, though sadly predictable, look at the Obama administration's Justice Department's backing of immunity for Saudis who were getting sued in connection with September 11th, and an even more infuriating and truly horrifying appearance by Michael Scheuer, the former head of the CIA's Bin Laden Task Force, on Glenn Beck's program on Fox, in which basically Scheuer says, wouldn't it be a good thing if Al-Qaeda lit off a nuke or some such thing in the United States? It would really wake America up. If I were to give you my candid opinion of that appearance and that statement, it would offend the FCC because I'd have to reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary. But all of this really is indicative of the fact that the golden rule is in effect. He who has gold rules. And because the Saudis have a tremendous amount of black gold, they also have a lot of the yellow kind. And in addition to the simple political clout of the petroleum industry itself and the bribery with which they've managed to achieve tremendous influence in Washington, there is a tremendous amount of capital invested by the Saudis in everything from American T-bills to major American corporations, media corporations in particular. And when taken in conjunction with the investment on the part of other Middle Eastern oil-producing kingdoms in major corporations, it gives them a virtually irresistible amount of corporate clout. And just as the profound U.S., British, and other Western corporate connections to the Third Reich and to Japanese and Italian fascism necessitated in the minds of the powers that be a cover-up of the involvement of those elements in the events around World War II, so too those same types of corporate interests, including overlapping corporate interests and overlapping families, such as the Third Reich and September 11th complicit Bush families, a cover-up has basically been effected of the Saudi links to al-Qaeda and the resulting corporate connections and national security connections, which have resulted in a cover-up of the American links to al-Qaeda as well. In fact, one of the more interesting degrees of overlap is the fact that the Saudi Bin Laden Group, the major construction company, which is the primary commercial venture of the powerful Saudi family, is represented legally by Sullivan and Cromwell, the powerful white shoe law firm that was also the spawning ground for Allen and John Foster Dulles, and that also helped to invest Bush family money, as well as a great many other elite families' monies, in the Third Reich and the fascist infrastructure of World War II. In the five-part series we're about to access, Garrett Porter points out that from the very get-go, the Saudis were covering up significant indications of al-Qaeda involvement in the Khobar Towers bombing. That took place on June 25th of 1996. It killed 19 U.S. Air Force personnel and wounded just under 400. And from the very beginning, the Saudis were covering that up, covering up the complicity of elements of the Saudi elite in funding al-Qaeda. And among the elements that collaborated with the Saudi cover-up was Louis Free. Again, the title of the broadcast, Free at Last, is a pun on that, F-R-E-E-H. And because of that, the perpetrators of the Khobar Towers bombing did go free, and remain free, frankly. So to be noted here is how basically Louis Free delivered the Bureau. He basically compromised the FBI's investigation of the Khobar Towers bombing in a manner not unlike the way his successor, Robert Mueller, helped to deliver the Bureau and compromise the Bureau's investigation of the events of September 11th. We're going to take a look at that. Even though the fact that Louis Free was a Clinton administration appointee, he was very close to both Georges Bush. One of the uniting elements was Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, an individual deeply involved in various covert operations with the United States over the decades, plural, and an individual whose name has now been at the very epicenter of the multi-billion-dollar Al-Yamamah slush fund, which is being investigated in Britain. Louis Free, as we're going to see, worked with both Georges Bush in order to cover up Khobar Towers. He and Prince Bandar, that is to say, Louis Free and Prince Bandar, enlisted the aid of the elder George Bush in helping to cover up the Khobar Towers bombing. And the younger George Bush, when he got into office, kept Louis Free in office until just after mid-June of 2001. And Louis Free continued to do what he was there to do, which was to compromise what otherwise would have been a vigorous FBI investigation of the complicity of the Saudi elite in terrorism. We're going to take a look at how there was a misdirection play, whereas the evidence from the get-go pointed in the direction of Sunni and al-Qaeda-linked elements. From the get-go, the Saudis were pointing the finger incorrectly, demonstrably incorrectly, at Iran and Shia as the authors of the act, whereas there not only was no substantive information collaborating that or corroborating that, but in fact, it was pretty obviously a lie. We're also going to take a look, too, at torture. Of course, torture has been very much in the news in recent years and months. And indeed, torture is literally routine to the legal investigative process and national security investigative process of Saudi Arabia. And some of the false confessions that were obtained were almost certainly obtained by torture. And it was known to U.S. investigators who were playing it straight, that was the case. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as impugning the integrity of the FBI as a whole here, but the Bureau was delivered, just like a Thanksgiving turkey, by Louis Free, just as Robert Mueller delivered the Bureau like a Thanksgiving turkey, stuffed and dressed in the wake of September 11th. The first part of the story by Garrett Porter is called Al-Qaeda Excluded from the Suspects List. This was dated June 22nd. It's published by the Interpress Service News Agency. And again, a major tip of the hat for this heroic effort to Garrett Porter. His first name, by the way, G-A-R-E-T-H. Part 1 reads, on June 25th, 1996, a massive truck bomb exploded at a building in the Khobar Towers complex in Khobar, Saudi Arabia, which housed U.S. Air Force personnel, killing 19 U.S. airmen and wounding 372. Immediately after the blast, more than 125 agents from the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation were ordered to the site to sift for clues and begin the investigation of who was responsible. But when two U.S. Embassy officers arrived at the scene of the devastation early the next morning, they found a bulldozer beginning to dig up the entire crime scene. Of course, parenthetically, that would destroy forensic evidence and compromise an investigation. Continuing, the Saudi bulldozing stopped only after Scott Erskine, the supervisory FBI special agent for international terrorism investigations, threatened that Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who happened to be in Saudi Arabia when the bomb exploded, would intervene personally on the matter. U.S. intelligence then intercepted communications from the highest levels of the Saudi government, including Interior Minister Prince Nayef, to the governor and other officials of Eastern Province, instructing them to go through the motions of cooperating with U.S. officials on their investigation, but to obstruct it at every turn. That last sentence once again. U.S. intelligence then intercepted communications from the highest levels of the Saudi government, including Interior Minister Prince Nayef, to the governor and other officials of Eastern Province, instructing them to go through the motions of cooperating with U.S. officials on their investigation, but to obstruct it at every turn. That was the beginning of what interviews with more than a dozen sources familiar with the investigation and other information now available reveal was a systematic effort by the Saudis to obstruct any U.S. investigation of the bombing and to deceive the United States about who was responsible for the bombing. The Saudi regime steered the FBI investigation toward Iran and its Saudi Shia allies with the apparent intention of keeping U.S. officials away from a trail of evidence that would have led to Osama bin Laden and a complex set of ties between the regime and the Saudi terrorist organizer. The key to the success of the Saudi deception was FBI Director Louis Free, who took personal charge of the FBI investigation, letting it be known within the Bureau that he was the case officer, unquote, for the probe, according to former FBI officials. Free allowed Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar bin Sultan to convince him that Iran was involved in the bombing and that President Bill Clinton, for whom he had a visceral dislike, quote, had no interest in confronting the fact that Iran had blown up the towers, unquote, as Free wrote in his memoirs. Interrupting, Prince Bandar bin Sultan is so close to the Bush family that his operating nickname, including within the members of the Bush family, is Bandar Bush. Continuing, the Khobar Towers investigation soon became Free's vendetta against Bill Clinton. Quote, Free was pursuing this for his own personal agenda, unquote, says former FBI agent Jack Clunan. A former high-ranking FBI official recalls that Free, quote, was always meeting with Bandar, unquote, and many of the meetings were not in Free's office but at Bandar's 38-room home in McLean, Virginia. Meanwhile, the Saudis were refusing the most basic FBI requests for cooperation. When Ray Mislach, who headed the National Security Division of the FBI's Washington field office, requested permission to go door-to-door to interview witnesses in the neighborhood, the Saudis refused. It's our responsibility, Mislach recalls being told. We'll do the interviews, unquote. But the Saudis never conducted such interviews. The same thing happened when Mislach requested access to phone records for the immediate area surrounding Khobar Towers. Soon after the bombing, officials of the Saudi secret police, the Mabahith, began telling their FBI and CIA contacts that they had been arresting members of a little-known Shia group called Saudi Hezbollah, which Saudi and U.S. intelligence had long believed was close to Iran. They claimed they had extensive intelligence information linking the group to the Khobar Towers bombing, but a now declassified July 1996 report by CIA analysts on the bombing reveals that Mabahith claims were considered suspect. The report said the Mabahith, quote, have not shown U.S. officials their evidence, nor provided many details on their investigation, unquote. Nevertheless, Free quickly made Iranian and Saudi Shia responsibility for the bombing the official premise of the investigation, excluding from the inquiry the hypothesis that Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization had carried out the Khobar Towers bombing. Quote, there was never, ever a doubt in my mind about who did this, unquote, says a former FBI official involved in the investigation who refused to be identified. FBI and CIA experts on Osama bin Laden tried unsuccessfully to play a role in the Khobar Towers investigation. Jack Clunan, a member of the FBI's I-49 unit, which was building a legal case against bin Laden over previous terrorist actions, recalls asking the Washington field office, which had direct responsibility for the investigation, to allow such I-49 participation, only to be rebuffed. Quote, "The WFO was hypersensitive and told us to F blank 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 off," unquote, says Clunan. The CIA's bin Laden unit, which had only been established in early 1996, was also excluded by CIA leadership from that agency's work on the bombing. 2 or 3 days after the Khobar bombing, recalls Dan Coleman, an FBI agent assigned to the unit, the agency, quote, "locked down its own investigation, creating an encrypted, quote, pass line," unquote, that limited access to information related to Khobar investigation to the handful of people at the CIA who were given that code. The head of the bin Laden unit at the CIA's counterterrorism center, Michael Scheuer, was not included among that small group. Nevertheless, Scheuer instructed his staff to put together all the information the station had collected from all sources, human assets, electronic intercepts, and open sources, indicating that there would be an al-Qaeda operation in Saudi Arabia after the bombing in Riyadh the previous November. The result was a 4-page memo which ticked off the evidence that bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization had been planning a military operation involving explosives in Saudi Arabia in 1996. Quote, "One of the places mentioned in the memo was Khobar," says Scheuer, again quoting, "They were moving explosives from Port Said through Suez Canal to the Red Sea and to Yemen, then infiltrating them across the border with Saudi Arabia." A few days after receiving the bin Laden unit's 4-page memo, the head of the CIA's counterterrorism center, Winston Wiley, one of the few CIA officials who was privy to information on the investigation, came to Scheuer's office and closed the door. Wiley opened a folder which had only one document in it, a translated intercept of an internal Iranian communication in which there was a reference to Khobar Towers. "Are you satisfied?" unquote, Wiley asked. Scheuer replied that it was only one piece of information in a much bigger universe of information that pointed in another direction. Quote, "If that's all there is," he told Wiley, again quoting, "I would say it was very interesting and ought to be followed up, but it isn't definitive," unquote. But the signal from the CIA leadership was clear. Iran had already been identified as responsible for the Khobar bombing plot, and there was no interest in pursuing the bin Laden angle. In September 1996, bin Laden's former business agent, Jamal al-Fadl, who had left al-Qaeda over personal grievances, walked into the U.S. Embassy in Eritrea and immediately began providing the best intelligence the United States had ever gotten on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. But the CIA and FBI made no effort to take advantage of his knowledge to get information on possible al-Qaeda involvement in the Khobar Towers bombing, according to Dan Coleman, one of al-Fadl's FBI handlers. Quote, We were never given any questions to ask him about Khobar Towers," unquote, says Coleman. And again, this is the first of a 5-part series. The title of the series, Khobar Towers Investigated, How a Saudi Deception Protected Osama Bin Laden, unquote. And by the way, Garrett Porter notes that this wonderful piece of work was supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Now, note the indications that there were explosives being brought into Saudi Arabia in order to be used for attacks in 1996. As we're going to see, there was considerable dissembling by the part of Saudi investigators on those explosives. And you're going to hear reference here to an attack in Riyadh. That was an attack on the office of the program manager of the Saudi National Guard in November of 1995. There was a deliberate misdirection on the part of Saudi investigators, corroborated in its entirety by FBI Director Louis Free, who again delivered the bureau to the conspirators in this case, in conjunction with Bandar Bush and later the elder George Bush, and in the conclusion of this, this unholy scenario, the younger George Bush, for whom Louis Free worked for about 6 months. We're also going to take a look at for whom Louis Free works now. Let me give you a hint. It's a Saudi prince whose last part of whose nickname is Bush. And it really is indicative of the sort of relationship that this is exemplary of which this is exemplary. Part 2 of the investigation from June 23rd, again by Garrett Porter, Saudi account of Khobar bore telltale signs of fraud. Now, pay close attention to the bait and switch that the Saudi investigators use here about the importation of explosives, which appear to have been used for the Khobar Towers bombing. And the overall amount of explosives, as subsequent pieces in this series will reveal, was massive. Roughly 5,000 pounds of explosives, 2.5 tons of plastic explosives. That is a lot of firecrackers, folks, and the estimates were it would have taken roughly 50 carloads of explosives to travel across the very closely monitored Saudi border to accomplish that. And that appears not only an altogether unlikely scenario, but frankly, there's evidence that the Saudi officials were complicit with this, and in turn, elements of the U.S. investigative establishment as well, including former FBI Director Louis Freeh. This piece, again, Saudi account of Khobar, bore telltale signs of fraud, reads, "In the last week of October of 1996, the Saudi secret police, the Mabahith, gave David Williams, the FBI's assistant special agent in charge of counterterrorism issues, what they said were summaries of the confessions obtained from some 40 Shia detainees. The alleged confessions portrayed the bombing as the work of a cell of Saudi Hezbollah that had carried out surveillance of U.S. targets under the direction of an Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps officer before hatching a plot to blow up the Khobar Towers facility. But the documents were curiously short of the kind of details that would have allowed U.S. investigators to verify key elements of the accounts. In fact, Saudi officials refused even to reveal the names of the detainees who were allowed to have made the confessions, identifying the suspects only by numbers 1 through 6 or 7, according to a former FBI official involved in the investigation. Justice Department lawyers argued that the confessions were completely unreliable and unusable in court because they had probably been extracted by torture. At Attorney General Janet Reno's insistence, both Reno and FBI Director Louis Freeh said publicly in early 1997 that the Saudis had provided little more than hearsay evidence on the bombing. There were also major anomalies in the alleged confessions of Shia plotters that should have aroused the suspicions of FBI investigators. The Saudis claimed that on March 28, 1996, Saudi guards at the Al-Haditha border crossing with Jordan had discovered 38 kilograms of plastic explosives hidden in a car driven by a Saudi Hezbollah member. That member not only admitted to his Saudi Hezbollah membership, according to the Saudi account, but led the secret police to 3 more Saudi Hezbollah members who were allegedly arrested on April 6th, 7th, and 8th. Again, the year here, 1996. The Khobar bombing was in June of 1996, June 25th. Continuing, what was peculiar about that account is that on April 17, 1996, Saudi officials had announced that they had found explosives in a car at the border with Jordan on March 29th and said that, quote, a number of people, unquote, had been arrested. And 4 days later, Saudi Interior Minister Prince Nayef had announced the arrest of 4 men in the bombing of the Office of the Program Manager of the Saudi National Guard in Riyadh on November 13, 1995. Their confessions were broadcast on Saudi television that same day. In the announcement of the arrests, reported by the New York Times, Nayef referred to the arms smuggling attempt of March 29, saying it was still not clear if the November blast in Riyadh, that's November of 95, and the smuggling attempt were related. That statement had clearly implied that Saudi officials had reason to believe that there was a link between the jihadist network believed to have carried out the Riyadh bombing and those who had been caught after the March 29th explosive smuggling attempt. After the Khobar bombing, however, the Saudis began to link the interception of explosives in late March to the Shia they were saying had carried out the Khobar Towers bombing. One day in July, according to a former Clinton administration official, Freeh came into the White House Situation Room livid with anger, telling officials there that he had just learned that the Saudis had arrested a Saudi Hezbollah activist in March with concealed explosives and had discovered the Shia plot to bomb Khobar Towers. Nayef's statement suggesting a possible tie to the Riyadh bombing of the previous November was a deliberate deception of the United States, which the Saudis never explained to U.S. officials. Quote, "We asked why they didn't tell us about this earlier and didn't get an answer," says Williams. If the Saudis had actually arrested the 4 Saudi Hezbollah members who had been ordered to carry out the bombing, as they later claimed, it would have been known immediately to the rest of the Saudi Hezbollah organization, which would obviously have called off the bomb plot and fled the country. Further undermining the Shia explosive smuggling and bomb plot story is the fact that the Saudis had secretly detained and tortured a number of veteran Sunni jihadists with ties to Osama bin Laden after the bombing. The Sunni detainees over Khobar included Yusuf al-Uyari, who was later revealed to have been the actual head of al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. In 2003, al-Uyari confirmed in an al-Qaeda's regular publication that he had been arrested and tortured after the Khobar bombing. A report published in mid-August 1996 by the London-based Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi, based on sources with ties to the jihadi movement in Saudi Arabia, said that six Sunni veterans of the Afghan war had confessed to the Khobar bombing under torture. That was followed 2 days later by a report in the New York Times that the Saudi officials now believed that Afghan war veterans had carried out the Khobar bombing. A few weeks later, however, the Saudi regime apparently made a firm decision to blame the bombing on the Saudi Shia. According to a Norwegian specialist on the Saudi jihadist movement, Thomas Heghammer, in 2003, shortly before al-Uyari was killed in a shootout in Riyadh in late May of 2003, an article by the al-Qaeda leader in the al-Qaeda periodical blamed Shia for the Khobar bombing. Note the degree of coincidence here between the official Saudi account and the official al-Qaeda account, or at least as basically described here in an article in the al-Qaeda publication. Continuing, in a paper for the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, Heghammer cites that statement as evidence that al-Qaeda wasn't involved in Khobar. But one of al-Uyari's main objectives at that point would have been to stay out of prison, so his endorsement of the Saudi regime's position is hardly surprising. Al-Uyari had been released from prison in mid-1988 by his own account, but he was arrested again in late 2002 or early 2003, by which time the CIA had come to believe that he was a very important figure in al-Qaeda, even though it didn't know he was the leader of al-Qaeda in the peninsula, according to Ron Suskind's book, The 1% Doctrine. In mid-March of 2003, Suskind writes, U.S. officials pressed the Saudis not to let him go. But the Saudis claimed they had nothing on al-Uyari, and a few weeks later he was released again. The head of al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi secret police were playing a game. The question of how the alleged plotters got their hands on roughly 5,000 pounds of explosives, the estimated amount on the truck bomb, was one of the central questions in the investigation of the bombing. But interviews with six former FBI officials who worked on the Khobar Towers investigation revealed that the investigation had not turned up any evidence of how well over 2 tons of explosives had entered the country. Not one of the six could recall any specific evidence about how the alleged plotters got their hands on that much explosives. And one former FBI official who continued to defend the conclusions of the investigation flatly refused to tell this writer whether the investigation had turned up information bearing on that question. If the Saudi Hezbollah group had actually been plotting to bring the explosives into the country by hiding them in cars, they would have had to get more than 50 explosives-laden cars past Saudi border guards who were already on alert. There is no indication, however, that any additional cars with explosives came across the border in the weeks prior to the bombing. And again, note the collaboration of various forces, Louis Freeh delivering the FBI, other FBI agents following the bureaucratic leader, so to speak, and collaboration between the Saudi elite and elements of al-Qaeda. And as we're going to see, both George Bush and Prince Bandar Bush helping to lead the way in this particular conspiracy. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 679, Free at Last, the Khobar Towers investigation, subtitled Love Means Never Having to Say You're Saudi, Part 2. This program is being recorded on July 12th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.